From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, dub poet Lynton Kwesi Johnson on music, journalism, rap. We'll talk also about police brutality. Students around the country protest and close down chancellor's offices, protesting sweatshop labor. We'll find out the latest. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The general population of the Supermax prison at Pelican Bay, California, is on lockdown after a riot where guards opened fire on inmates, killing one and wounding 12 others. The riot between 200 black and Hispanic prisoners broke out about 9:30 Wednesday morning in an exercise yard within the highest security wing of Pelican Bay State Prison. Again, this is according to prison authorities. We don't have a version of what happened from the prisoners. Located 20 miles south of the Oregon border and about 290 miles north of San Francisco, Pelican Bay houses close to 3,500 prisoners. About 1,200 are in permanent lockdown conditions. The fighting sent a total of 28 inmates to local hospitals. Meanwhile, two former guards have been charged with violating the civil rights of Pelican Bay inmates. A federal grand jury indictment made public yesterday accused the men of conspiring to arrange assaults on prisoners, one of them fatal, over a nearly three-year period. Another former Pelican Bay guard, David Lewis, was convicted of civil rights charges February 14th for shooting a prisoner after a fight in 1994. Anthony Bryan has been executed in Florida. He was the second death row prisoner to die in Florida in 2 days. He and Terry Sims were both executed by lethal injection, the first Florida executions in 76 years not to use the electric chair. Bryan was convicted of killing a night watchman in 1983. At a news conference this week, he said he couldn't recall the crime, but said he didn't think he should die for it. He became a born-again Christian on death row. And Governor George W. Bush, Jeb Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida, George Bush, of course, presidential aspirant and governor of Texas, will be off the campaign trail and back in Texas today as the state gets set to execute another death row prisoner. 62-year-old Betty Lou Beets is set to die after 6 p.m. Central Time for the 1983 shooting death of her fifth husband. A federal judge in Austin yesterday refused to halt the execution, and her attorneys plan a last-minute appeal. The Texas Parole Board has already refused to commute her sentence, and Bush could grant only a 30-day delay. Bush says he'll be studying all the facts and deciding whether the jury heard all the circumstances. Her new lawyer says it didn't. He says Beets was the victim of severe emotional torment. She would be the second Texas death row prisoner to die in as many days, and only the second woman to be executed in Texas since the Civil War. Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee Chair Robert Torricelli, Senator of New Jersey, said he will introduce a resolution condemning Bob Jones University, which bans interracial dating and, he said, promotes anti-Catholic teachings. Torricelli said there are many of us who are not going to remain silent when the reputation of the Catholic Church and the actions of Catholics are being disparaged. While Republican presidential candidate George Bush has come under fire for kicking off his South Carolina campaign at the school, Democrats have now criticized Republican Senator John Ashcroft of Missouri, Congressmember Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and Arkansas Congressmember Asa Hutchinson for receiving honorary degrees from the university in May. All three lawmakers say they disagree with the school's racial and religious policies. Hutchinson attended the school as an undergraduate, along with his brother, Arkansas Senator Tim Hutchinson. At the request of the police chief, federal authorities announced they will play a major role investigating Los Angeles's widening police corruption scandal. Six FBI agents will work with police and prosecutors. So far, 20 officers have been suspended and 40 criminal convictions have been reversed since a former anti-gang officer accused of stealing cocaine from an evidence locker began telling prosecutors that fellow officers framed innocent people, lied in court, and even shot suspects. The Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office is looking into as many as 3,000 criminal convictions that may have been tainted by police misconduct. The announcement came amid calls for an independent investigation. The city council on Tuesday delayed a decision on an independent investigation by asking a committee to further review it. And a group of black Secret Service agents reportedly wants to file a lawsuit against the agency that's charged with protecting the president. The Washington Post says the agents are asking the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission for permission to file a class action lawsuit. The agents say they were denied promotions and key assignments because of racial discrimination.
Sometimes I think my co-workers are crazy. The way Christine would have gone jokey-jokey. And the next time, no, I know nonsense stands. The way she wind up the place, last Christmas dance. The way she love to talk about conspiracy. Me and Christine in the canteen a talk about the death of black people in a custody. How not a cat make me yow or a damn dog bark? How nobody high up in a society can offer explanation nor remedy? When Christine it up her brow like say a row, she have a row. Screw up her face like say a trace, she have a trace. Hear her now. You think I just MI5 and James Bond and police and soldier over North Island one? When it come to black people, Winston, some police in England got license for kill. Well, nothing Christine said surprise me still. But hear me now. What you mean, Christine? And who tell you that? I must you an idiot. You can't prove that. I would tell me if you go say that. Christine kissed her teeth, then she cut me with her eye and she said, you want proof? You can't ask Clinton McCurbin about him asphyxiation. And you can't ask Joy Gordon about her suffocation. You can't ask Colin Roach if him really shoot himself. And you can't ask Vincent Graham if he's him stab himself. But you can ask the commissioner about the license to kill. Ask Sir Paul Condon about the license to kill. You can't ask the Douglas them about the new style baton. And you can't ask Tony Hassan about him dead by neglect.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Linton Kwesi Johnson will be with us soon live in the studio. That from his CD, LKJ. But right now, we are going to an event that's been taking place over the last few weeks around the country at the Universities of Michigan, University of Pennsylvania, and University of Wisconsin. And they are protests taking place in chancellor's offices, calling for an end to the use of sweatshop labor in making college sports apparel. We're joined right now by two people from Madison, Wisconsin. Eric Bracken is one of the students who has been leading a national effort against sweatshops. And Molly McGrath is a student at University of Wisconsin, one of more than 50 students who got arrested this week in the chancellor's offices. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Hello.
Hi. Why don't we start with Molly? Molly, what year are you in at University of Wisconsin?
I'm a senior.
And tell us what happened this week.
We occupied our chancellor's office on Wednesday, February 16th, and had permission to stay there until Monday. And on Sunday morning at about 4:30, about 54 people were arrested after he called the university police in to remove us.
Can you explain exactly what your protest was about, what exactly you're calling for?
We had about 7 demands, but basically it was for him to terminate membership in the Fair Labor Association and to pledge to a 5-year membership in the Workers' Rights Consortium. And what those things are both monitoring organizations for factory workers that produce apparel that's licensed to colleges and universities.
Eric Bracken, you're one of the people who started this whole movement. Explain how it began and what the Fair Labor Association set up by the corporations are and how it contrasts with the Workers' Rights Coalition that groups around the country are calling for their universities to join.
Yeah, students have been kind of examining this link between their universities and the leverage that they have over companies that you sweatshop labor for a few years. And last year, if people remember, there were a lot of protests of a similar nature, and it was essentially asking universities to take a stand on the issue to hold companies accountable for basic worker rights. After those protests started to happen and a lot of national attention was focused on universities in the anti-sweatshop movement, a number of universities received a letter from the Department of Labor calling on them to become full members of the Fair Labor Association. This was last March, and it was done without any of the students who had begun this movement and pushed their universities to take a stand, knowing that it was happening. The Fair Labor Association at that point was suffering a pretty extreme crisis of legitimacy, because just a few months earlier, all of the labor and religious representatives who had been in the negotiations and setting up how this association should run and work and try to stop sweatshop labor had pulled out of it, saying that it was nothing more than a corporate front, saying that it was weak on several counts, including that it allowed companies to submit a list of which of their factories around the world would be subject to inspections by independent monitors, that those companies would get to select which monitors would be inspecting their factories, that those factories would receive advance notification of monitoring visits happening, and, you know, more generally, that you would have Americans flying in, parachuting in to a place like El Salvador or Indonesia for a few days without the workers' trust, and expecting that they're going to find the truth in an industry where workers know that they can't speak the truth to most people. By contrast, students along with non-governmental organizations, labor unions, religious groups, both here in the United States and throughout the world, have been developing since last spring this mechanism called the Worker Rights Consortium. And instead of developing it in classrooms and boardrooms in the United States, we've been doing it by actually traveling and speaking with workers in Central America and Southeast Asia, soliciting feedback from organizations that we know throughout the world, and trying to construct something which is actually going to find out the truth and is going to try and empower workers and support their efforts of trying to create substantive change in their factories. So it's much more of a worker-centered system, one that's being supported and has energized, I think, a lot of the anti-sweatshop community throughout the world. And it's something that if we get universities to endorse and to become participatory members in this, has the chance of creating leverage over the industry and beginning to pull this industry from behind the cement block walls that it hides behind the barbed wire, out from behind there, making it a little bit more accountable to the public.
Molly McGrath and Eric Bracken, we are going to switch gears just for a few minutes, and I'm going to ask you to bear with us because our next guest has to catch a plane. But because the next subject involves the execution of a woman tonight in Texas, we want to be able to talk to him before he leaves. But then we're going to come back to you. And also, I want to play for you a quick conversation I had with Spike Lee the other night about how he feels about your protests. Spike Lee, who has been a spokesperson for Nike. And we also are going to expand the discussion to Don Yeager, who is one of the authors of Soul Influence, Basketball, Corporate Greed, and the Corruption of America's Youth. But that's coming up in a few minutes, because right now we're joined by Joe Margulies, and he is the attorney for Betty Lou Beats. Betty Lou Beats is the 62-year-old woman who is set to die today at 6 p.m. Texas time for the 1983 shooting death of her fifth husband. Governor George Bush is off the campaign trail back in Texas today as the state gets set to execute Betty Lou Beats. And if she does die tonight, she will only be the second woman to be executed in Texas since the Civil War. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Joe Margulies.
Good morning. I just want to alert folks, and I'm sorry for this. This cell phone that I'm on is in its dying gasps. I hope it's not a premonition of things to come later this evening. If we want, we could try to reestablish on a different line. But let's go ahead now for as best we can.
Okay. Why don't you explain the situation of Betty Lou Beats at this moment? Does her legal case stand?
There are two things going on right now. The first is there is a challenge to the procedures employed by the Texas Board of Pardons and Paroles and their failure to follow state law, their own procedures regarding clemency procedures in place for the review of battered women. That is pending in the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. We anticipate that if we are successful and get a stay there, the Attorney General will seek to vacate the stay so they can kill Betty tonight. If we are unsuccessful, then we will seek a stay in the United States Supreme Court. We are also still waiting on Governor Bush. We have asked him to do what the Board of Pardons and Paroles has refused to do, and that is to stop the execution and hold a live hearing so that they can hear the witnesses that the jury should have heard that were available to the trial lawyer, but who he declined to investigate and present that could document Betty's history, Betty's horrific history, as a reason to spare her life.
And what is that history? What would they say?
Betty's, we have established through abundant documentation, contemporaneous records, as well as eyewitness accounts, the abuse that Betty has endured virtually throughout her life. She is an incest survivor, raped at the age of 5, married at the age of 15, married to a succession of abusive, violent men, documented in photographs taken by her daughters. Some of her daughters' earliest memories as small children is pushing the door closed so that their stepfathers couldn't, the succession of stepfathers couldn't come through the door to keep beating on their mama. They took photos of her after she had been beaten and gave those photos to her trial lawyer and said, look, if you're going to understand Betty and defend Betty, you've got to know this history. And this is just the picture that begins to tell the story. And none of that information was presented. He did nothing to investigate that. Hmm. We also know that Betty suffers from organic brain damage after a car accident. We have the records. She was suffered a skull fracture in the accident. Not abundantly demonstrated and established in psychological and psychiatric evaluations conducted afterwards, all of which could have been done at trial, none of which was presented to this jury. As a result, they're left with this fundamentally incomplete impression about who this woman is and what the circumstances were surrounding these killings.
Are there questions about her killing a second husband and shooting a third?
No, this is not a case about innocence. This is a case about explanations. We are not saying that Betty didn't do this. What we are saying is that unless you understand why a woman with this history acts when the threat recreates itself, unless you understand that, you're left with a fundamentally incomplete picture of why. In fact, what you're left with is the capacity to characterize this as the Black Widow. That's just an extraordinarily incomplete picture, which is why battered women's organizations all over the country have come out in support of Betty's claim. The National Coalition for the Defense of Battered Women, statewide coalitions representing battered women's organizations in over 30 states have signed on asking the governor to either commute Betty's sentence down to life or to grant her the hearings to allow a fact finder to finally hear this evidence, which has been denied her ever since the case began.
Joe Margulies, what do you make of Governor Bush returning to Texas today?
Well, we are hopeful that it's a good sign. Obviously, if he were not here, someone would act in his stead. But there'd be no reason for him to come back to Texas simply to preside over another execution. But we think that he can and would deserve the benefit of the political being that would come from coming to Texas to stop an execution. And if there were anything that would demonstrate the compassion to his conservatism, it is a thoughtful review of this case. So we think that coming off the campaign trail back to Texas is a hopeful sign.
And what, let me ask you about the parole board vote. Two votes. One denied clemency appeal unanimously, but her request for an 180-day delay to consider evidence of abuse was denied by a 13-5 vote. What's the significance of that?
We think it's extremely significant. Five votes is almost unheard of in Texas clemency proceedings. And two of those people specifically identified that the reason they wanted to stop the execution was to give Betty the benefit of the state law that mandates heightened clemency review for battered women. The other three we don't know, but two we know explicitly that that was the reason for it. There's a recognition that this case, A, is different. Most of these clemency votes go 18-0. And B, it's different because of Betty's history, because of the failure to give her the benefit of what the law allows. And that's all that we're asking. Governor Bush has said what he is about is access to the courts, access to what the law allows, and whether the jury heard all the evidence. And in both respects, Betty's case has failed. It is a demonstration of what has gone wrong in capital cases in Texas. The jury did not hear this evidence, and she was not given access to what the law allows. And that's all we're seeking.
Joe Margulis, I want to thank you for being with us. If there is a number that people can call to get more information or to voice their view, do you have one on hand?
I'm sorry, I packed that. Let me do this. If you'll give me a number, I'll call the studio back and I'll get that and you guys can read it.
Okay. We will put you on hold during the break and our producer will pick up and get that, give you that number. Joe Margulis is the attorney for Betty Lou Beats. She is set to deny tonight at 6 o'clock. She's 62 years old. She would only be the second woman to be executed in Texas since the Civil War. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! At the end of the show, we'll get you a phone number. We'll be back, though, now in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. In just a little while, we'll be joined by the great dub poet, Linton Kwesi Johnson. But before we do that, we wanted to go back to our conversation with two students, one who's just graduated from the University of Wisconsin and one who is a senior. The one who is a senior, Molly McGuire, was just Molly McGrath was just arrested this week at the chancellor's office at the University of Wisconsin, protesting the policies of the university and calling for the university to pull out of the Fair Labor Association, which is a corporate-based group that voluntarily monitors corporations that make the clothing for college sportswear. And more than 50 students were arrested there. Students protest at the University of Michigan and University of Pennsylvania as well. Eric Bracken is with us, who's one of the founders of the anti-sweatshop student movement in this country, also now out at the University of Wisconsin. Eric Bracken, right now, where do you see the movement around this country?
Well, it's actually pretty strong. It's grown pretty dramatically in the past year to now where it's we estimate somewhere over 175 campuses have students running this sort of campaign. And, you know, literally in every part of the country, in places where there's not traditionally a lot of student activism of any kind, now there's actually even statewide and regional networks being drawn up with a lot of solidarity in between campuses. And that actually is, solidarity is something which is pretty evident in the entire movement right now. where lots of students have been coming out in support of each other's campaigns on other campuses. In the middle of the University of Pennsylvania sit-in a couple weeks ago, they wanted to draw more national attention to what they were doing, so they called for a two-day fast, and students at over 60 universities joined them in a two-day fast and drawing attention to what was going on there. After the arrests at the University of Wisconsin just a few days ago, we received reports of banner drops going on at other campuses saying Free the Madison 54. There were students at Penn State University, over 45 of them, who entered their president's office and demanded that he get on the phone immediately to call the chancellor at Wisconsin and demand that he drop all charges and accede to the students' demands. So this sort of thing is starting to mark the student movement right now.
I wanted to play for the two of you a comment or a little conversation I had with Spike Lee. It was right near the Apollo Theater just a few days ago when Bill Bradley and Al Gore were having their final debate before the March 7th primary. And Spike Lee was there to endorse Bill Bradley. And I had a chance to go up to him and ask him about the protests that are taking place. You have to listen carefully because it was, to say the least, a very noisy room. It was where the spin was happening after the debate when everyone was coming out and endorsing either Gore or Bradley.
This week, students have occupied the offices of, in the last few weeks, of the chancellors of the University of Pennsylvania, University of Wisconsin, University of Michigan, and they're protesting the clothes that are made by the university, sports clothes, being made in sweatshops. You know the whole controversy around Nike and sweatshops, and I wanted to know what your response to it is.
I think anytime students make a stand is good because, for the most part, I think the students are apathetic, but it shows that they care about what's going on in the world.
But having you yourself having worked for Nike, what about the criticism, especially of young people, saying that these corporations have to be a lot more responsible and that celebrities like you should be critical of them, not giving them more status?
What kind of question?
I wanted to ask what you thought about it. It's a question that many, many people ask.
Damn, I'm not here for that now.
No, but I would never get to see you otherwise.
Is that my fault?
I answered the first part.
Saying you think that it's good that students speak.
Yes, I said that.
But what do you think about the whole issue? I'm sure
you've answered the question already. I said I think it's very good what the students are doing.
Have you ever raised the issue with Bill Nye?
Yes, I have.
And what is your response?
Look, this is neither the time nor place for this. You know, you're not going to bum rush me, ask me a question. There's nothing to do. I'm here for Bill Bradley. All right, so I don't like your tactics.
That was Spike Lee after the Bill Bradley, Al Gore debate. Again, I had asked him what Phil Knight had said. He said he had a conversation with him, Phil Knight, the CEO of Nike. Eric Bracken, what is your response to Spike Lee, who, by the way, said he does endorse what's going on around the country, these protests?
Yeah. That's very good to know, and we may use that. But I think folks like him should know, folks like Michael Jordan and Kathy Lee Gifford should know that they have a pretty important voice in all this stuff, and if they actually did, publicly speak out in support of not only the students but in support of the worker struggles that are consistently going on in Nike factories and in other corporations' factories around the world, that they would have a tremendous influence. Unfortunately, a lot of times that we've tried to call for that sort of support, specifically from someone like Kathy Lee Gifford, we've been met with denials and questions about why we were trying to attack them. All we're doing is to ask them to take a stand in support of the workers.
Molly McGrath, your response to both Spike Lee's endorsement of what you're doing, but not feeling it was appropriate to ask him about his involvement with Nike, at least not at that time. I think he said it wasn't the time or place.
Well, I actually went to Indonesia to specifically look at Nike factories, and I think it's great that that he's both talked to people at Nike about the conditions that they're perpetuating and that he supports what we're doing.
So what are your plans now, Molly McGrath? You've been arrested along with 50 other people. Right now, what is the state of the decision of the University of Wisconsin Chancellor Ward around what his plans are?
Well, he has decided to go with a provisional membership right now in the Workers' Rights Consortium, the WRC, and
set up by students?
Well, it wasn't set up by students specifically, but students have been one of the main groups pushing for this new alternative to a corporate monitoring system like the Fair Labor Association. And he has terminated his membership in the Fair Labor Association. So right now what we're asking and what's going on is this sort of crisis of representation on campus. And I guess, like one person said, when there's not adequate representation, the masses will make democracy. And so that's what happened on campus here, and that's what's going to continue to happen until they adequately represent our moral consciences here. And so we'll be pushing, we'll continue pushing for more change in this area.
You got another kind of endorsement. This was from Phil Jackson, who is the coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. He was also at the Apollo the other night to endorse Bill Bradley. And I asked him what he thought about your protests.
Students are closing down chancellor's offices at UPenn, University of Wisconsin, University of Michigan, and they're protesting the fact that their college clothes are being made in sweatshops. What do you think about this?
Well, I think this is an issue of young people around the country. It has been for a while. It started, I think, you know, a few years ago with a variety of apparel that's going on. It started with tennis shoe factories that were being done all over the world in third world countries. And it's an issue for young people. That they see the world being used as a manufacturing ground for American products and the sweatshops that are going on now overseas. And I think it's great. I think it's great for kids to protest that type of thing. They have to understand what it means to our system and what it means to our ability to produce our own stuff and for the cost that it's going to cost us to put apparel on. That's okay. If you want to protest, and if we want to pay higher prices for things in this country, I'm all for it.
It really connects directly to this presidential race. Both Bradley and Gore support NAFTA, support the World Trade Organization. You came out for Bradley, is that right?
That's right.
So what do you say about that? They're saying that they're making it more possible for these companies to go abroad and exploit people because their governments won't protect them.
Yeah, but there's a certain amount of things that pressures that they can play upon that type of things, the NAFTA treaties, etc., that there are prices, there are certain limitations to that NAFTA treaty, which says there have to be wages paid to people. It's not something that is free, wide, open marketing that goes on in sweatshops. This is something that we're trying to say, hey, we've got to improve the rights of workers in Mexico right now as we are going through this period of NAFTA.
That is Los Angeles Lakers coach Phil Jackson speaking just after the Bradley-Gore debate. Eric Bracken, your response to his response to your protests around the country.
Well, I mean, I think he's right in that this is an issue, and in that this is something which hopefully will permeate in somewhat into the presidential race. And what's going on college campuses now is only an extension of, I think, a more general unrest that's going on, you know, by workers, by other community folks in this country. You know, obviously. Everyone knows about what happened in Seattle, and I think that's being reflected in a lot of places. And what's going on at universities right now is only students' most recent reflection of that. You can't open up and accede to corporate power around the world and allow companies like Nike, like Walmart, just to go anywhere they want without any basic respect for basic worker and environmental protection.
If people want to get in touch with the National Anti-Sweatshop Movement, where can they call?
Our phone number is 202-NO-SWEAT, 202-667-9328.
That's 202-NO-SWEAT. I want to thank you both for being with us. Eric Bracken of the National Student Anti-Sweatshop Coalition and Molly McGrath, a senior at University of Wisconsin, one of more than 50 students to be arrested this week in the chancellor's office at the University of Wisconsin. And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
We're marching out the old towards the new century, armed with the new technology. We're getting more and more productivity. Some say things looking up for prosperity. But if everyone gonna get a share this time, well, mentality must get left behind. We want the shorter working day, give it the shorter working week. Longer holiday, we need peace and peace. More time for leisure, more time for pleasure, more time for edification, more time for recreation, more time to contemplate, more time to ruminate, more time. We need more time, give it more time. A full time them abolish unemployment and revolutionize labor deployment. A full time them banish overtime, make everybody get a work this time. We need a higher quality of liberty. We need it now and for everybody. We need the shorter working year. Give it the shorter working life. More time for the husband, more time for the wife. More time for the children, more time for a friend, and more time to meditate, more time to pray, more time to living, more time for life. More time. We need more time.
More time, Lytton Kwesi Johnson. Don't we all need it? That is the name of his new CD. Lytton Kwesi Johnson, who is the world's leading dub poet, recording artist, journalist, a poet, broadcaster, political and cultural activist from Britain, actually has been touring in the United States, just came from Los Angeles, where you were involved with the annual Bob Marley Memorial Concert this weekend.
Yeah, we were playing in Los Angeles and San Diego, and they had two concerts in Los Angeles and one in San Diego, and each venue catered to about 20,000 people, and each show was sold out. I didn't realize how big reggae was here in the United States of America.
Well, being in Los Angeles, you might have gotten a chance to hear about the unfolding Los Angeles Police Department scandal. That
I've been following that from London, of course, from the Rodney King incident. Los Angeles has been in focus for a lot of people all over the world, and particularly for us in Britain, because there's so many parallels about police behavior vis-a-vis black people with you know, what's going on in England, with our own experience on that side of the world.
What is happening now? And what is the level of consciousness?
There is a... We've reached a watershed, so to speak. A young guy called Stephen Lawrence was murdered by some racists about 5 years ago. And the police really botched the whole investigation, which resulted in the people being apprehended and not being successfully prosecuted for the murder of Stephen Lawrence. And his parents campaigned vigorously and won a commission of inquiry from the government. And McPherson, the name of the man who led the investigation, made a number. Well, the first thing he said is he said that there is institutionalized racism within the British police force, and indeed in other institutions of government and so on. Which this is a remarkable thing because it has only been in recent time that the police, for example, would even admit that there was such a thing as racially motivated crimes. They would always invariably say, we have absolutely no evidence that race was an issue in a number of, blatantly racist attacks and so on. And the Lawrence as a consequence of the Stephen Lawrence thing, the inquiry made a number of recommendations to eradicate institutionalized racism, and the government has accepted this report. But of course, whether they will do something about it and how quick they will do something about it, I believe, depends on the amount of pressure which is exercised on the grassroots level.
We're talking to Linton Kwesi Johnson, dub poet, musician, journalist, cultural activist. And we'll talk about what role culture plays in advancing these kinds of issues when we come back here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined by Linton Kwesi Johnson, a dub poet, cultural artist, journalist. Tell us what dub poet means.
Well, I coined the term many years ago when I was at university, when I was writing a paper on reggae music. And I use the term to refer to the art of the Jamaican reggae DJs, you know, people like in the old days, Big Youth and U-Roy and Prince Jazzbo and so on. But the term was appropriated by my friend Okwunura and used to describe the kind of poetry that a group of young poets at the Jamaica School of Drama were, style of poetry that they were doing in the late 70s, early 80s, describing the work of himself and Michael Smith, the late great Michael Smith, and Gene Bintabrise, and myself, of course. So I've had to live with that term, but I think it was taken out of context. I've always seen myself as a poet, full stop. And if you wanted to categorize some of what I did, I always called it the reggae poetry. So although I coined the term dub poetry, and I've in a sense developed that style of poetry, and my name is associated with it, I've never ever called myself a dub poet.
Kigali must be sanitary workers. The butchers of Butari must be sanitary workers. The savages of Shatila must be sanitary workers. The beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers. Pram, pram, pram. In the new word order. Like a dirty old bandage from the festering face of humanity. Old order unravel and reveal. Old scar just a broke out in a new soul. Primeval wound that time won't heal, and in the ancient currency of blood, tribal tyrants are set to war score. The killers of Kigali must be sanitary workers. The butchers of Butari must be sanitary workers. The savages of Shatila must be sanitary workers. The beasts of Bosnia must be sanitary workers. Pram, pram.
New World Order by Linton Kwesi Johnson.
New word.
New word.
Order, not new world order. A slight pun there.
Now, you've been in Britain for many years, for more than two decades. You grew up there.
Yes, I went there, and I've been living there for over 30 years.
But I detect a slight Jamaican accent.
Well, you got me out of the country, but you couldn't get the country out of me.
Tell me a little about Jamaica.
Well, I'm kind of ambivalent about Jamaica. I love Jamaica, but I know there's a lot of things wrong with Jamaica. There doesn't seem to be any hope for poor people in Jamaica. And the situation has been so for the longest time. I sent a postcard to a friend of mine from Jamaica recently. I was there on holidays. And I said to him, greetings from the killing fields of the Caribbean. Because the amount of people who are killed in Jamaica is far more than where there are military conflicts going on. You know, like last year, I think it was over 1,000 people who died, who were murdered in Jamaica. A lot of the killings is domestic violence. It's as though the people have internalized the brutality of everyday life onto themselves, and it's really sad.
So you come here to the United States, you live in Britain. How do you take on the issue of violence? Here you're not just talking about state violence when you're talking about Jamaica, but you are talking about it when talking about the U.S. and Britain.
State violence is a problem in Jamaica too, because extrajudicial executions happen with monotonous regularity. A lot of ghetto communities in Jamaica are constantly complaining about police brutality. And there seems to be a sort of an arrogant disregard for due process. And surely that sort of thing will undermine the whole fabric upon which law and order is based. If those people who are responsible for upholding law and order are carrying out extrajudicial killings, then, you know, what kind of law and order can you have in a society like that?
How did you come to write License for Kill?
I wrote License for Kill because of not only mine, but the black communities in Britain's concern about the alarming incidents of black deaths in police custody in England. One of the most recent cases, in fact, was the case of Roger Sylvester, a young fellow who was being taken into protective custody, apparently, by the police, 8 police officers, and ended up dead. And a campaign is being waged right now called the Justice for Roger Sylvester campaign, trying to get to the bottom of it to find out how someone who has been taken into police custody for their own protection ends up dead.
Sometimes I think my poor work got crazy. The way Christine would have gone jokey. And the next time now, I know nonsense dance. The way she wind down the place last Christmas dance. The way she love to talk about conspiracy. Me and Christine in the canteen a talk about the death of black people in a custody. How not a cat make me yow or a damn dog bark? How nobody high up in a society can offer explanation nor remedy? When Christine it up her brow like say a row, she a go row. Screw up her face like say a trace, she a go trace. Hear her now. You think that just MI5 and James Bond and police and soldier over North Island one? When it come to black people, Winston, some police in England got license for kill. Well, nothing Christine said surprised me still. But hear me now. What you mean, Christine? I will tell you that. I must be one idiot. You can't prove that. I will tell me if you go say that. Christine kissed her teeth, then she cut me with her eye and she said, you want proof? You can't have stint on my curb about him asphyxiation. And you can't have strike garden about her suffocation. You can't ask Colin Roach if him really shoot himself. And you can't ask Vincent Graham if he's him stab himself. But you can ask the commissioner about the license to kill. Ask Sir Paul Condon about the license to kill. You can't ask the Douglas them about the new style baton.
And you can't ask Sunni Hassan about him dead by neglect. You can't ask Marlon Downs if him have any regret. And you can't ask El Gamal about the mystery I'm dead. But you can ask Dame Barbara about the license for kill. Ask the DPP about the license for kill.
License for Kill on More Time, Lytton Kwesi Johnson's CD, who joins us in the studio now, just having come from Los Angeles, the scene of an unfolding police scandal. I mean, for many people in the community, they've known about this for a long time, but it is breaking open. And the state, federal authorities, as well as state authorities, have to deal with it now. And now you come across the country to New York, where we are watching another story unfold once again over the last year. And this is a case of Amadou Diallo, four white police officers charged with his murder. And as we sit here, the jurors are deliberating in Albany, New York. What is your take on that as you looked across the ocean?
We find it incredible that four police officers should be involved in killing an unarmed member of the public. The number of bullets that was fired, as we understand it, it was something like 40-something bullets, and 19 of them went into the body of the person. It conjures up in your mind that what these cops must have thought, they were under attack from an army, because even if you thought you were under attack from a single individual, there would be no justification for firing so many bullets. We just find the whole thing extraordinary, and that something like that could happen in a country that is supposed to uphold democracy and the value of freedom and justice and all the rest of it. And it's as though even after Martin Luther King, after Malcolm X, after the Black Panther Party and so on, that nothing has changed.
What do you see as your role, Lytton Kwesi Johnson, as an artist, as a poet, in dealing with these issues?
I don't see myself as having any particular role as an artist, as a poet, or anything. I just see myself as having a responsibility as a human being to do whatever I can to oppose injustice wherever I find it.
Tell us about your piece, Poems of Shape and Motion.
Actually, it's a poem by a Guyanese poet called Martin Carter, who I've admired tremendously. He's the poet laureate of Guyana. And for me, he was the political poet par excellence. And he didn't not only wrote political verse and protest poetry and so on, he also wrote very deep philosophical poems. He has one of his poems where he has a line where he says, a mouth is always muzzled by the food it eats to live. I find that a really profound statement. He also has another poem where he says, life is the question asking, what is the way to die? A great poet, and he died year before last. And I recorded Poems of Shape and Motion because I believe that I kind of think of another poem that speaks to the human condition in a more effective way than that particular poem. And it was my way of paying my respects to Martin Carter.
I was wondering if I could shape this passion just as I wanted in solid fire. I was wondering if the strange combustion of my days, the tension of the world inside of me, and the strength of my heart were enough. I was wondering if I could stand as tall while the tide of the sea rose and fell. If the sky would recede as I went, or the earth would emerge as I came, to the door of the morning knocked against the sun. I was wondering if I could make myself nothing but fire, pure and incorruptible. If the wound of the wind on my face would be healed by the work of my life, all the growth of the pain in my sleep would be stopped in the strife of my days.
Poems of Shape and Motion, Linton Kwesi Johnson. And as we need more time, the name of your CD, More Time, let me just go out with two quick questions. And one is, I see you have your own label, LKJ. One of the biggest complaints of musicians, and certainly musicians of color, is not controlling their art.
Exactly. That's why I started LKJ Records, as a way of exercising some control over what I do. It's very difficult. It's an uphill struggle. All independents have been eaten up by the big multinational companies and so on. But I cannot think of another way of doing it, really.
How did you manage to get your own label? How do you beat them?
Well, it's quite simple. You know, it doesn't cost a lot of money to set up a company. What the problem is after that is how you get your product into the marketplace. And I'm still working on it.
And your inspirations, your biggest inspirations for your work?
I was influenced by an awful lot of people. I always talk about W.E.B. Du Bois, whose book, The Souls of Black Folk, began everything for me. And I've been influenced by all kinds of people. Franz Fanon, Malcolm X was one of my heroes when I was a youth, Huey P. Newton, people like that, you know, Angela Davis, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. We're in our election year now, 2000, and we've got people like George Bush running. George Bush, who just spoke at South Carolina Bob Jones University, you might have heard about it, a university that bans interracial dating, debates in this country like whether to fly the Confederate flag on top of the South Carolina State House.
They fly it in Georgia.
As well. So how does it compare to Britain?
What, your elections here?
And the whole state of this country.
I don't know if I could speak to that, but what I'd say is that if I lived in America, I probably, like most people here, wouldn't vote, because there seems to be such an absence of real choice.
Of course, you could run yourself.
This in America, elections are driven. It's about money, and I don't think I would stand any chance, because my finances are rather limited.
Well, Linton Kwesi Johnson, I want to thank you for being with us. Latest CD, More Time. And I also want to give out a phone number, speaking about George Bush and Texas. Again, tonight, the death planned for Betty Beats, 6 o'clock. And you can make a difference. You can let George Bush know how you feel. His phone number in Austin is 512-463-2000. That's the number that Joe Margulis, Betty Beats' attorney, just gave us. George W. Bush, the governor of Texas, who makes the final decision, is 512-463-2000. That does it for this show. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Errol Maitland, our technical director. Special thanks to Dred Scott Keyes. Linton Kwesi Johnson, thanks for spending the time.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York.
Officer Paul Condon about the license to kill. You can't ask the Douglas them about the new style baton. And you can't ask Tony Hassan about him dead by neglect. You can't ask Marlon Jones if him...
I'm Mark Cooper, contributing editor of The Nation magazine, and this is Radio Nation, a progressive review of news, politics, and culture brought to you by The Nation.